Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. The use of private contractors in war is not new. In the United States, you can trace their history all the way back to the Revolutionary War. But certainly, private contractors have never been used to the extent seen today in Iraq. They're used to transport supplies and to feed troops, jobs done by soldiers in previous wars. They also perform tasks traditionally done by military police and military intelligence. And this morning, we'll try to ask some very basic questions about the use of private contractors today. One of the basic questions would be, well, what are the costs? Are we saving money doing this? Is it more efficient? Perhaps more importantly, we ask the question, what does it mean for our troops that we are mixing combat troops whose primary goals are to succeed in battle and also try to protect each other, we're mixing them with private contractors whose primary goal is to make a profit for their employers and their shareholders. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Dina Razor and Robert Bauman. They're both investigators with the Follow the Money Project. It's investigating where money appropriated for the troops in Iraq and Afghanistan is going, especially money that should be going to the troops. Both of them have experience in investigating and exposing defense procurement fraud. Dina Razor trained as an investigative journalist. She's worked for several media outlets such as ABC News and the San Francisco Examiner. For 10 years, she directed the Washington, D.C.-based Project on Military Procurement, a nonprofit organization she founded, and she worked in its work with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and defense industry, exposing fraud and waste. Robert Bauman was a criminal investigator with the Department of Defense for 24 years. He specialized in the investigation of procurement fraud for over 17 years. That included 11 years as a special agent with the Department of Defense Inspector General, Defense Criminal Investigative Services. He's investigated successfully many large defense contractors and has been considered one of the leading authorities in the highly specialized field of procurement fraud investigations. Together, they are the authors of a recently published book that looks at the implications of this increased use of military contractors. The title of their book is Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War. Palgrave Macmillan is the publisher of the book, and it certainly should be available in the bookstore library if you want to take a look at it. Questions are welcome here on our program. The only thing we ask of callers is just that people are brief, and we ask that so that we can keep moving along here and get in as many different people as possible. But of course, people who are listening are welcome to call with their questions and comments. If you are here in Champaign-Urbana, where we are, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. At any point here, you have a question, comment, you can certainly give us a call. Ms. Razor, hello.
Hi.
And Mr. Bauman, hello.
Hello.
Thanks to both of you very much for giving us some of your time today. We appreciate it. And
well,
you guys, you know, feel free in answering questions to pass back and forth. It's always a little difficult in a show like this where you've got two guests and nobody has eye contact. So feel free to go back and forth. I'm glad both of you could be talking with us this morning. Mm-hmm. You certainly make the point in the book, as I did in trying to introduce the subject, that private contractors have been used in war in the United States going back a long time, but that not nearly to the extent that we see now in Iraq. And I just wonder, you know, can you put some numbers on that? How many private contractors there are in Iraq, and can you make some comparisons between that and previous wars?
Well, one of the problems is that as we began to write this book, one of the things that surprised us when we started looking at this a couple of years ago is how no one knew how many contracts were let, how much money was being spent. I mean, even after the initial invasion, and people didn't know. So first there was an estimate of 25,000 contractors in Iraq. Then the Army was forced by the Congress to kind of look at it and go back and they said, well, we think we've got 100,000 contractors. But now LA Times did a freedom of information request and got the information of all contractor employees in Iraq and did a story. It turns out there's 180,000. So there are more contractors now than there are soldiers.
Hmm.
This is done on a scale that's never been done before. Contractors have been used in the past, but never right there in near the battlefield. And the ratio in the Gulf War was about 1 to 100. And before that was the first time we had that many contractors. And before that, they were used behind the lines, but they were not used, unfortunately, like this war, as the major supply chain for the occupation.
Hmm. That, I suppose, just leads to the natural question of why it is that in this particular conflict we have so many contractors performing those tasks that previously were done by soldiers.
Well, Bob, maybe you want to tell about why they got into it.
Yeah, Secretary Rumsfeld, at the start of, or even before the war, had put a cap on the number of troops that were going to be used, as I think most of us know, and it was in the neighborhood of around 150,000. But the problem was is that that also included logistics personnel. Since they wanted to use most of those 150,000 as trigger pullers, as combat units, that left a huge a gap in the number of logistics people, so they decided to outsource that privately and outsource the supply chain, and because contractors did not count on troop levels. And so instead of increasing troop numbers, they were increasing contractor levels to the point of where it is now. And that does not just include the logistics end, it also includes the intelligence, security, a lot of the what used to be the police functions of the Army now is being handled by private security contractors.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to be clear here, I think that there has been quite a bit of attention focused, or at least some attention has been focused on those private contractors who are doing this kind of security work, people who are carrying guns and who have a military combat security police sort of function. If you look at the numbers that are doing that and then the numbers that are doing the other kinds of things that are involved in transportation of supplies, are the ones that are involved in making sure that the soldiers have food and water and spare parts and ammunition, all that kind of thing that are not trigger pullers. When you look at the numbers, I would guess that the people who were involved in this kind of infrastructure supply kind of stuff, that there are a lot more of them than there are people who are doing the security work. Is that
true? Yeah,
that's correct. Yeah,
very
much
true. And KBR, which is used to be a part of Halliburton, is really the 900-pound gorilla as far as supplies. And you got to think. You got to remember. Yes, you have the cowboy armed guys going around, and this is a problem. But you also have to remember that there is a thin thread of supplies that go from base to base to base in these truck convoys. And truck drivers are from employed by KBR, and the Army provides the protection. The problem is that in these long convoys, the Army truck drivers in the past were allowed to carry guns because, of course, they were soldiers. But these truck drivers are not allowed to carry guns, and so they rely on the U.S. Army. Well, when the U.S. Army gets drawn off in a firefight, you know, they blow up something in the beginning of the convoy. There's actually been situations where the sergeants then run around to the back end of the convoy where they know that the Army isn't there and start pulling out the truck drivers and shooting them one by one. So you have this situation where you're putting civilians in a harm's way thing, plus, of course, the supply chain, and they can't defend themselves, and then, of course, that supply chain is what keeps the bases running.
Mm-hmm.
And so by privatizing this part of it, they have made it more dangerous and less effective and getting it through. So, yes, probably the more scary aspect is these, you know, free-wielding cowboy guys running around with guns who don't answer to the military, and yet Paul Bremer actually gave them a waiver that the Iraqi government can't go after them, no matter what they do. So they are in this sort of lawlessness situation. But the real thing that really hurts the troops is the day-to-day logistics problems that they have and not being able to keep up supplies and not being able to take care of them and not being able to get the stuff they need. And that has to do with the more unglamorous day-to-day logistics, which the Army has outsourced in a way they've never done before.
Yeah. And just I do want to underscore the point. Now, certainly I did not mean to suggest that these people, the contractors who were doing those jobs, were not exposed to danger, because they are.
Right.
So that certainly is an issue for them as well. I don't suppose you can be in Iraq and not be exposed to danger, no matter what it is that you're doing.
Yeah, that's one of the problems. In past wars, they didn't use contractors that much, but they used them beyond the front lines. Well, there are no front lines in Iraq. Mm-hmm. Anyone can be blown up anywhere at any time. And so we're saying that because of the failures we outlined in our book, we're saying, we need to pull these people back to Kuwait, where they're no longer that way. Now, here's the problem with this, too, is that the people who are going in, when the military goes in, they have a job to win, and they have for their comrades, for their buddies, they have this loyalty. Unfortunately, with the contractors and the employees are very upset about this, it's a profit motive. So when they don't want to do something, they just don't do it. And there's no uniform code of military justice to force them to do it. I mean, we have soldiers give up some of their constitutional rights to serve because you have to make them do something against their own self-interest. And no matter how loyal or patriotic or anything, you have to have the fear of going to jail. Well, what we're finding with a lot of these logistics contractors and stuff, if either the employees or the contractor either the contractor employees or the contractor themselves don't want to do something, they can just refuse to do it. And they've done it over and over, even threatening at one point work stoppages in a hostile zone, and the Army just has to cave and pay. They just cave in and pay and cave in and pay. And KBR is billing $500 million a month.
Let me just ask one more quick question. Then I want to introduce you guys again, just for people who might have tuned in. Just again, when I asked this question, well, why is it we're using so many contractors? The answer is that the man who was the Secretary of Defense at the time, Donald Rumsfeld, wanted to do this job, wanted to do Iraq with as few troops as possible, but he wanted to make sure that all of the troops that were in there, getting as many people who were capable of fighting as possible. So for that reason, these other kinds of jobs that didn't immediately involve fighting were outsourced. Would it have been the case that if he had made a different sort of decision, that we could have had soldiers doing these jobs that previously soldiers had done? I mean, was there anything of a personnel issue, or would you say, no, well, it was not the case that we didn't have the people to do it. We could have done it.
I think we could have had more people in the initial invasion. Now, there is always a personnel problem. People talk about that. But if you can't, you can't send the soldiers out there and then ask them to put their lives on the line and rely on equipment and food that's coming from somebody with a profit motive. So if we can't get enough people to fill out our armed services the way we traditionally did, we better rethink what we're doing. I mean, Bob and I are not talking about whether the war should be or not to be. But the fact is, when you send soldiers in this situation with contractors, you're not just hurting the taxpayer, you're hurting the soldier. So as a result, there is this, there is this problem. And I fault Rumsfeld for doing this in the beginning, but I fault the Army, especially the General Officer Corps, for once they were in there and the invasion and stuff, allowing the contractors to, literally at times blackmail them at the expense of their troops.
Hmm. Our guests in this part of Focus 580, Dina Razor and Robert Bauman, they're both people who have long experience in investigating and exposing defense procurement fraud. They're also now involved as investigators with a project they call Follow the Money, which it takes a look at where money appropriated for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is going. And they are also the co-authors of a book that they titled Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War, that explores in some detail this subject we're talking about here this morning. So you can read more about it by looking at the book. Palgrave Macmillan is the publisher. Questions are welcome, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. Let me ask you a different question here, come at it at a slightly different angle, and look at the amount of money that's being spent on private contractors, that is what they're being paid by the U.S. government to do these jobs. And if we just for a moment set aside the question of how well they're doing the job and what that means for the troops. If all you did was look at the money, and you ask the question, you know, what are American taxpayers getting for their money? How has this worked out? Has this been cost effective? Are we saving money? Is it cheaper doing it this way than if military people were doing it? Or is this, in fact, costing us more?
Well, Bob, I don't think anybody yet has within the government, or at least within Department of Defense, has come up with comparative numbers as to whether it was cheaper or more cost efficient to use contractors versus military in the same roles. However, there is a lot of speculation. We already know what the costs are for paying the for having the contractors over there. It's just for the LogCAP contract, which is a primary logistics contract, not counting security contracts, is around $26 billion, and contractor employees themselves make anywhere from $80,000 to $120,000, $150,000 tax free if they're over there for close to a year. Per person with benefits, where the soldiers make anywhere from what $20,000 to $30,000, the lower level military personnel, privates and so forth. So there is a lot of concern as to the cost factor. We believe it's far more costly to have the contractors over there than if the soldiers had been used in the traditional roles to begin with.
You also have to just look at it historically. We're almost to the level, and this is all constant dollars, okay? This is all constant dollars. We are pretty much getting close to the level in this war that we spent in the entire Vietnam War. Now, the Vietnam War was 12 years long and had up to 500,000 troops in the field at any one time. And went on for years, was another, like Iraq, extremely complicated because of the heat and the jungle and the logistics and all that kind of stuff. And yet, this war is barely 4 years old, and we've already gotten a burn rate of burning through the same as the Vietnam War. It was 12 years long. And many, many, many more men under uniform that you had to support. So you have to look at it that way, that it's clear to me that this war in constant dollars is a lot more expensive than past wars. Now, what is the difference in the factor of it? It's not actually paying the servicemen instead of having them drafted, because those soldiers are paid outside the war. They're paid whether they're sitting in the United States or they're paid whether they're in war. They get a little bit of a bonus, but not much. So the only really huge different factor, because this was, you know, ground war just like Vietnam. We're not doing the bombing, though, constant bombing. But the main factor is that the contractor support costs are so high. Mm-hmm. You know, you have a one-to-one rate like that. It's just amazing that our big frustration is, if you're having a one-to-one ratio with a contractor, those soldiers should be living high on the hog. Well, if they're at one of the big bases where the military brass is, and where KBR is trying to impress everybody, they do live well. They get soft serve ice cream or Rectents and everything else. But once they go out on patrol, once they leave the bases, they can't get enough food and water. They can't get enough fighting equipment. I can't tell you how many soldiers told us, well, yeah, I love coming back to the base and getting all these fancy things like little mobile Burger Kings and all that kind of stuff, but I'd much rather have the right kind of armor or a night vision goggles when I go out to fight. And because so much money is going towards this with the logistics, they're not giving the soldiers the equipment they need.
Yeah.
We've heard that over, you know, the American public's got to be puzzled of thinking, why is it that no matter how much money we seem to pour down this, the soldiers aren't getting enough this, they're not getting enough that, you know, it's because the contractor billings are out of sight. and out of control and basically almost unscrubbed, and they're sucking the supplemental money up to the detriment of giving the soldier what they need.
Well, I think this is a real important point. And I said that, you know, just in asking the question about cost, I said, let's set aside this question for a moment. But you certainly cannot set aside that question here, because what we're talking about is the well-being of the troops.
When the contractors overbill and you have a supplemental budget to run this war, okay, this is not coming out of the regular DOD budget. You have a supplemental budget to run this war, and that money's got to go somewhere. And they keep pouring money into making sure they've got night vision goggles, making sure they've got MRAPs, those new trucks that now they're going to be delayed because of production problems. That is the thing that, you know, the Congress keeps pouring money into. But in the beginning of the war especially, the money wasn't designated to go to these things. It was just whatever you need for the war, because the and as they did that, they had to cover the contractors' overbillings, and they didn't have the money to do the stuff that they really needed to fight the war. A best example I can give is the thing that we start the book out, which is really one of the most outrageous things, is the idea that we were able to verify this over and over again, that at bases, when the contractor KBR would run up against putting in their bills and the bills not being paid by the government because the government was trying to scrub them and KBR was billing late, you know, there were delays. KBR came in and told the general of the base, I mean, this is multiple times this has happened, you know, unless you call Washington and we get paid right now, which means, of course, not through the right kind of scrubbing of money and whatever you need to do, our guys aren't coming out of the trailer and feed your troops. This is work stoppage in a battlefield. Now, you know, they had a legal right to do that, by the way, according to peacetime procurement rules, but this is not peacetime. So these generals, to a person, caved. And what happened is KBR is getting their bills paid. Well, somebody had to pull that money out of somewhere, and they pulled it out of the supplemental. Now, to the credit of the Congress, especially Jack Murtha, he got fed up about putting all this money towards these things, and now he's trying to designate, okay, this money can't be used for anything but this, you know, but for the soldiers to get this kind of equipment or that kind of equipment. But they're still going to keep trying to rob Peter to pay Paul, because the contractor billings are out of control.
We have a couple of callers here, and let's talk with them. They're both in Champaign, so we'll start with line one. Hello.
Yeah, hi. How much, in terms of estimate, how much fraud do you think is going on in terms of these contractors? Do you have any estimate, or is it?
I don't have an estimate, because the problem is, what's amazing is what we don't know after 4 years. I mean, the Pentagon for a while couldn't tell you how many contractors there were, how many contracts were let, and how much money was being spent. And they couldn't quantify it, and they kept saying, well, it's war, but, you know, it's been 4 years. But I think Bob Bellman will agree with me. We've both been investigating defense fraud and our whole careers. We have never seen anything like this. This is, you know, this is probably the most blatant, out of control, because the Pentagon isn't doing their oversight. They're just now trying to start to, because they're getting pressure from Congress, and Congress hasn't done any oversight. This is the biggest procurement power grab I've ever seen in my lifetime, and I'm sure Bob agrees with me, right, Bob?
Well, I think one of the big indicators, and it is an indicator, since the defense auditors have started scrubbing the contract or the costs, that there's been, they have questioned tens of millions of dollars already on the billings that have been submitted, and those numbers are growing almost by the day. Unsupported and questioned costs, and that usually means that there's a considerable amount of fraud if one were to look into it a lot more. So,
well, the other frustrating thing about that, though, is when the investigators and auditors of the Pentagon started saying about KBR, hey, wait a minute, saying to the contract managers, you know, there's a lot of fraud. You got to get control of this. Everything else, don't give them their bonuses. Don't give them this. Don't pay them that. The Army overruled people over and over again, and in a way that, to me, smacks of political influence.
Okay. Well, again, I hope that gets at the caller's question. Let's go to another Champaign person. This is line number two. Hello.
Yes, thank you. Well, a couple of things. First of all, actually, we are doing a lot of bombing, and one of the things that's gone larger than reported is that there's been a significant and steady increase in the number of bombing missions in Iraq, and one of the plans for making a transition to a time when the Iraqis will be doing more of the fighting is that they will get a lot of air support, so they intend to have even more air activity going on with this, you know, you giving cover and bombing support by the Air Force and Naval planes from the aircraft carriers. But, you know, I mean, I think a lot of this, and maybe this was part of Rumsfeld's plan in terms of limiting the number of soldiers or troops going in, is that, you know, Cheney was in charge of back, you know, when he was in the head of the Defense Department, you know, in previous administration, was in charge of setting up a whole plan to put this mechanism in place. And, you know, him and his crony capitalists intended to make a lot of money. And when he went to Halliburton, that's when the biggest increases in the, you know, profits that came when he was head of Halliburton was from these government contracts that, you know, they were doing with the military and other government agencies. And, you know, I mean, I think that's a big part of this whole operation is a way of flooding money into, you know, these private contractors, which all have connections to them.
There's no doubt about that. In fact, we have a whole chapter on that, which I'll defer to Bob. But what we found is that they usually try to evenly split this between Democrats and Republicans when you do defense spending and everything else, or depending on who's in charge and everything else. This was a very much a neocon cronyism group. I've never seen so much cronyism. And Bob can also talk about this, but when you finally look at the lobbying, we were sort of laughing at the end of this chapter because every single person that was lobbying for what we call the war service industry, this new industry that services war, all roads kind of led to Tom DeLay. Everybody who worked for Tom DeLay or involved with Tom DeLay ended up, you know, being involved in being the lobbyists for these companies.
Well, if they outlawed this sort of thing and we were forced to go to a draft, you'd see an end to these kinds of wars. And I think that, you know, part of the plan was that they knew they can't get away with, you know, having another draft and being able to, you know, then go to war because of the political consequences of that. So that, you know, they figured this is not only a good way to be able to carry on imperial wars, but also grease their palms.
And we don't get involved in the politics of it, because what we try to do is we're talking to a lot of some soldiers who believe in the war and others who don't, contractor employees the same way. What we're trying to say is you can't use contractors the way you've been using contractors, because the soldiers have been definitely suffering and lives have been lost because of this contractor situation. And therefore, if you can't do what you need to do without putting contractors in the battlefield, then you better restructure and think about what you're doing. Because when you commit troops, you have to promise them that you will get the logistics to them, you will get them the equipment they need, and the support they need to save their lives. And if you can't do that, then you've got to rethink what you're doing.
We are a little bit past the midpoint here. I have some other callers I'll get to in just a minute, but for the benefit of anyone who might have just tuned in the last 5 or 10, I'd like to introduce again the guests, Dina Razor and Robert Bauman. Both of them have considerable experience investigating defense procurement fraud. Dina Razor has been doing that for over 25 years. She trained as an investigative journalist. She's worked for ABC News and the San Francisco Examiner. Also for 10 years, she directed the Washington, D.C.-based Project on Military Procurement, which she founded, that worked with whistleblowers and sources inside the Pentagon and defense industry, exposing fraud and waste. Our other guest, Robert Bauman, was a criminal investigator with the Department of Defense for 24 years. He specialized in the investigation of procurement fraud for over 17 years, and that included 11 years as a special agent with the Department of Defense Inspector General. Now, they are both investigators for a project called Follow the Money, which is looking at where the money appropriated for the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan is going. And they are also the co-authors of a book that explores the subject. So again, if you'd like to read more, you can look for their book. The title is Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War, published by Palgrave Macmillan. So we are now coming into about our last 20 minutes, and we have a number of callers. We'll try to get as many in as we can. But again, callers can help us by being brief and realize they're sharing the space with others. Next, we'll go to Champaign County, and this is line number 3. Hello.
Hi. Yeah, I feel directly addressed in that. Thank you.
No, I didn't mean it like that. No.
Okay, go. Let's not waste the time on the... I wanted to know whether David's question about the ratio, or he didn't ask explicitly in the ratio, but how many are mercenary contractors, military contractors, opposed to handling the baggage? Do we know now? I understand that Jan Schakowsky in Northern Illinois has had the some kind of oversight bill even before the Democrats took the House, and I don't know how whether that's happening. You sort of pointed out that there still isn't enough oversight.
Well,
I'm wondering what's
unfortunately,
happening.
Unfortunately, none of the oversight things have passed. None.
None of them.
No.
Well,
well, there are some bills floating around.
Yeah. They just
on that, but nothing. Nothing has been.
I've heard term as much as 30,000 for the. You know, the numbers change. What is amazing about this war is what we don't know. Bob and I had to write this book, and being investigators, we like dealing in facts. You know, we like dealing in statistics, and we had to deal instead by interviewing a lot of people because there just was so much unknowns, and they were just happy with that. And I understand that maybe the first year of a war, but you're 4 years into the war, and I can't imagine in World War II that they didn't know how many people they had doing what and how many contractors they had. I mean, it's just, I think there's chaos, but I think the contractors love the chaos because you can't investigate them when there's chaos.
Is it still true that there's been no legal proceeding against any contractor? They just get pulled out and...
Well, there have been legal proceedings against a few contractor employees on bribes. There have been some bribery scandals, a lot of that. Beyond that, no. There was a security contractor that has allegedly shot an Iraqi guard who was immediately flown out of the country, and there's I don't know what's going to be happening there. There's really no law to do anything about it. That
I can tell you that where the Army Material Command at Rock Island Arsenal, which is in you guys' neck of the woods, is actually has a Justice Department task force and people looking, because there have been, they're all under seal and in secret, but there have been some whistleblower suits that have been filed, and some have been public, but not many have gone public yet, and the Justice Department's looking to see about accepting those suits. But the fact is there is a task force, but there is, you know, the task force may come up with something, but it's going to be up to the Justice Department to prosecute. And right now, I don't think the Justice Department we have is interested in doing that.
That would put them pretty close to Freeport, which is one of Blackwater's enclaves that they've just opened up. And I don't know if this is a regional story or an academic story, but the U of I has had, the Police Training Institute here has had contracts of some kind, a memorandum of understanding, with both Triple Canopy and Blackwater. The Blackwater one is more notorious now because the head of the unit is over in Afghanistan working for them while he's on vacation from the U of I. It's a huge scandal. I don't know whether it's broken through to the national press.
I've seen some things on it. They also have opened up a facility down in San Diego, and people just don't want them around because the fact is they're building, they're interested in having this giant mercenary army from all over the world, and we need a lot. All this happened so fast because Rumsfeld was given the task, and then he gave the generals the task. They had 8 weeks to prepare for this war, and so it was a scrambling situation. And now here we are 4 years into it, and things are getting established. Money is being spent. You know, lobbyists are getting involved. This war service industry is becoming part of now our American military, and no one has thought about the long-term consequences of this. It's all been, you know, do what you have to do right now, but we are setting ourselves up to be very sorry in the future that our military is going, while the contractors take over this stuff, the military is allowing their logistics arms to atrophy because the contractor's supposed to be doing it. And so even if we get rid of the contractors, the military is going to have to take over these things again, and I think it makes our Army exceptionally weak.
Let's go to another caller. The caller here is in Effingham. It's line number one. Hello.
Good morning.
Mm-hmm.
What is Congress doing about it? I mean, it seems to me that they're the ones that have the power to do something about it, and what's, in your opinion, what's the reason they're not?
Well, I think that right now they're trying to dig themselves out of the information hole. The Democrats, you know, and like I said, I'm not partisan. I don't care if it was the Republicans or Democrats, whoever's doing it, I support it. Congressman Waxman and people, they're starting to try to quantify this, Jack Murtha and stuff. But probably the most important effort is all of the Democratic freshman senators, especially Claire McCaskill and James Webb, have introduced this bill to have a new Truman Commission like they had during World War II. Truman actually was head of a commission when he was a senator investigating the war while it was going on for fraud. And what they're trying to say is we can't wait until Iraq is over to look at this fraud, because remember, we're going to be there for a while. No matter what anybody says, we're going to be there for a while. And the money, the meter is running. Even if we pull out troops, we're still going to do it. So I think that's probably the best thing we have right now, because the Pentagon seems to be unwilling to really get a grip on this.
So you think it's lack of public pressure then?
Yes. It's lack of public. The public gets the idea that there's something wrong, but they don't quite get it. And that's one of the reasons we read the book, is to try to get people to do that. And I write for Huffington Post blog, and we have our own blog at our website. We're trying to get it out that the public needs, just the same way the public got fed up with overpriced spare parts in the 1980s and the wasteful spending of the defense budget, then people have to start caring that the soldiers aren't getting what they need. Well, we're taking it in the neck with the taxpayers.
All right, thank you.
Let's go to Charleston here, line number four. Hello.
Two questions, historical. Early on in this Iraq war, I saw in the TV news one or two tractor trailers with bales of money, American money. I don't know if that was a sham or a scam or what, but the newspaper reporter said that these one or two tractor trailer loads of money were there, and they showed the vehicles. The second question, historically, is in World War One and World War Two. I'm an older person, and I remember the talk about, especially in World War Two, that G.I. Joe had to buy his uniform and boots and his clothing straight up. And I'm wondering if those things were true.
Well, I don't know about World War II, but right now the soldiers get a clothing allowance. But they can't get the equipment they need to fight. That's the main thing that we're talking about now. And so,
well, let me add this.
Yeah.
There are soldiers that are complaining about the fact that they're issued equipment, a certain amount of equipment, whether it be rifles and night vision goggles or other kinds of paraphernalia they need in combat, that if they come back to the U.S. without any of that, they have to pay for it.
And certainly there have been cases where soldiers were concerned about the quality of the stuff that they've been supplied with, body armor, for example, and have actually decided for their own personal welfare to go out and buy their own.
That's correct. Certainly early on in the Iraq conflict, there were a number of soldiers who were using catalogs and what have you to purchase body armor and other kinds of equipment. And there were mothers and wives of soldiers who were organizing to buy equipment and things to send over to their troops, to the troops.
And how can this be happening when we're spending $9 billion a month? How can this be happening? And what it's pointing to is that the contractors are sucking the money out. These soldiers aren't getting what they need because the Pentagon is bowing to the pressure of the contractors. I often say to people, you know, I can't imagine that what General Patton would have done is some contractor said, I'm not going to feed your troops tomorrow unless you pay me. He would have taken a gun and stuck it up the guy's nose and said, if your boys aren't feeding my boys, I'm going to come blow your nose off.
Mm-hmm. I want to thank the caller again. Let's go to line number two. This is Urbana. Hello.
Hi. It seems to me that there's a ripple effect back to the United States. An example was, I'm certain I heard this on WYLO, a reporter who ran into security people from Blackwater who didn't want to admit who they were, hired at $240 a day, is what I recall, per person to provide extra security during or after Hurricane Katrina in New Orleans?
Yes, Blackwater was hired to
protect property.
To protect property in New Orleans, that's correct.
And how much would a National Guard person have been paid for that same amount of work?
not any more than what they were doing before.
Not $240 a day.
Right.
It certainly wouldn't have been $200-some a day. It would have, depending on their rank, it could be, $15,000, $20,000 up to maybe $40,000 or $50,000, depending on how high up they are. But it's certainly nowhere near what security contractor employees would be making.
Well, and plus the fact you have to understand how angry the troops are when they see this. They see these people being paid all this money, and they're not getting, paid. And then a lot of the troops, when the contractor can come and go in whenever he wants. They can go back. They can quit their job and go home anytime they don't want. A lot of these guys are saying, "Why should I stay in the military and go through my fourth or fifth tour in Iraq when if I have to go back there anyway? Why don't I quit and go work for a contractor and make a lot more money and leave whenever I want?" And so the military has been bleeding people to these contracts, having to pay more and more to keep up the amount of money of bonuses and everything else. Not only are we paying the contractors too much, we're now having to pay a lot to get the military to stay in. And they are, you'll see all the way through our book, because we wrote it like a novel, following about 11 people through this whole war and occupation, how much they resent the fact that they can't get what they need, but the contractors are being overpaid.
And for the people who are doing the security work, those kinds of contractors, are most of those people former military?
Yes.
They're former military or former law enforcement, mostly.
Hmm.
Although there are some that don't fit either category, but that most have had military experience or law enforcement experience.
Let's talk again with another caller. This is Urbana, line number three. Hello.
Hello. As I recall, the Truman Commission did uncover significant fraud. I wonder if you would comment on my assertion that there are groups who prolong the war, and one way in which they do it is, take for instance Afghanistan, indigent farmers whose main source of income is our poppies. Our government comes along, plows under their crop, does not give them sufficient alternatives, thereby destroying their livelihood. Well, it doesn't take a genius to realize that he is going to be a enemy of the United States because the United States destroyed his livelihood. If you'd comment on that, please.
Well, I think that part's true. That's getting a little bit into foreign policy. But here's another way to look at it. And this is the thing that we're most concerned about in the book. We've dubbed it the war service industry because it's unlike the military-industrial complex. The military-industrial complex makes weapons and has plants, whether we're fighting or not. You know, all through the Cold War, they loved it because they didn't have to have a boogeyman. They had a boogeyman, but they never had to fight, so they spent a lot of money on weapons and everything else. And so as a result, a lot of the military actually didn't want to go to war because it took away from their weapons buying budget. But this new industry, which we dubbed the war service industry, they have to have a hot war or occupation to keep going and getting their money. So the first time we have people invested in keeping hostile action or occupation going, because what are they going to do? What if we got out of Iraq tomorrow? Are you think they're going to easily go quietly into that good night and have their companies go down to, you know, a small amount? No, I'm afraid they're going to lobby to get more done, keep going and keep being involved in the war, and that very much concerns me.
All right, let's talk to somebody else. This is also Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
I just would like you to say the title of the book again, because I turned in late, and I think this is a superb show. One follow-up that listeners might think of doing after they read this book is to watch the DVD Iraq for Sale, in which an awful lot of low-level employees of KBR, Khaki, Titan, Blackwater are interviewed and tell firsthand of the inefficiency and waste and how devalued they feel as employees of those organizations. Oh, and you can get Iraq for Sale at That's for Entertainment on campus. Thank you.
All right. Well, and again, I can do as the caller suggests. The title of the book that our two guests, Dina Racer and Robert Bauman, have written, the title is Betraying Our Troops, and it's published by Palgrave Macmillan. The subtitle is The Destructive Results of Privatizing War, and it does indeed, the topic that we were talking about here this morning, it explores it in greater depth. So if people want to take a look at it, they certainly can. You can find it out in the bookstore. I don't know, anything else in specific that in response to what the caller had to say that you would want to comment on? I don't know if you're familiar with that particular documentary.
There are, yes, Iraq for Sale does provide visual information, certainly as to what we're talking about to some extent. And there are also, there are more documentaries that I think are being made, and some that have been made in the past that do address some of the same issues, or at least bring up the fact that there are problems using contractors in Iraq. And we're also not talking about just Iraq, and we're also talking about the future, the potential of future conflicts, and using the same level of contractors in those conflicts.
Yeah.
And we are setting policy now that could affect us long into the future.
Well, I think that's certainly a very important point, and you have touched on that in the conversation. But I think it's worth, again, underscoring. I asked back at the beginning how many contractors there were and how that had changed over time. And I think you said something like in the last Gulf War, there was one contractor for every 100 soldiers. And in Iraq now, there are actually more contractors than soldiers.
That's correct.
And that we're coming to, that this sector that you have called the war service industry, you think that this is the way that it's going to, that fighting wars it's going to be for the United States now from now on, that a lot of these functions that in the past had been performed by soldiers and were directly part of the Department of Defense, where this kind of outsourcing is just going to be the way it's going to be in the future?
Well, it's certainly the way it's going now. It could be, but again, with public pressure, with congressional inquiry, with more oversight and so forth, we might find that the cost is just way too much and to do it this way, and it has to be scaled back or certainly modified in some significant way. One of the big problems is we didn't have much oversight, very little, if any, oversight for so long that essentially contractors just run amok over there in terms of costs and billing the government. And it's going to take a while, I think, to really get a grip on the total impact that it has had on the taxpayers' money. And I think once that happens, I think there's going to be some rethinking of the scope of using contractors in those kinds of situations.
Hmm. And yet, you know, as we know, one of the things I guess we know about Washington is the wheels grind very slowly. You know, it can take a long time for things like this for the Congress to deal with things like this. Are we talking about a process that to get a full accounting and to really get to understand what happened here and then perhaps do something about it? Are we talking about years and years?
Well, I would think so. But the good thing about the only good thing about this is that there are soldiers that have been willing to talk real time. You know, usually sometimes it takes years to find these things out. But we tried to expose this early on because it's much better to try to fix it while it's still going on before it becomes so entrenched that then there's so much political pressure it can't be. And the Congress is starting to do that. But the fact is, they're afraid to question costs. They're afraid to question the contractors during a war. And the only way they're going to overcome that is public pressure. And that's, you know, we can sit there and investigate and file fraud suits for years to try to get some of them, a small percentage of the money back. But the only reason we wrote this, if we would really instead like to try to get the problem solved, because it's so hard on the soldiers. And it's so frustrating to see the kinds of situations they've had to deal with while we're spending way too much money.
Yeah, and if we wait till after the Iraq conflict is over, then it's sort of out of sight, out of mind, and the pressures aren't going to be there to get these things done, to try to get reforms done, to try to really get a grip on what happened. So I think now is the time to put public pressure on, to expose as much as possible, to really find out what it's costing us, both in terms of money and the fighting capability of the troops.
All right. Well, there we're going to have to stop. Let me say before we go here again that our two guests, Dina Razor and Robert Bauman, are investigators with the Follow the Money Project, which looks at where the money appropriated for the Iraq and Afghanistan wars is going. They have a website. If you'd like to find more about it, go to followthemoneyproject.org. And then if you would like to read the book that we've mentioned here now several times, you can certainly do that. Try to find it in the bookstore, the library. The title is Betraying Our Troops, The Destructive Results of Privatizing War. Palgrave Macmillan is the publisher. And I want to say thanks to our two guests here. Dina Razor, thank you very much.
Sure, anytime.
And Robert Bauman, thank you.
Oh, thank you. It was a pleasure.